Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So let me start with John the 23rd. So his encyclical in 1961 was called Mater et Magister, Mother and Teacher. That's the title for the church. And he made a really important point. One of the things that, people were thinking by the 1960s, and I remember just being a little kid growing up, and you even got some of this at school, was now we've reached a scientific and technological age. We've managed to solve so many problems. Humanity has such a bright future, and we can build this great civilization on our own. We can build a civilization without God. Religion is for, you know, primitive societies that are afraid of everything and don't understand things and haven't mastered nature. But now, you know, with technological and scientific advance, religion just isn't that important anymore. And John says, in fact, it's the opposite. It's more important now because we've created now things that could be engines of destruction. He was thinking in terms, I think, mostly of weapons, but I would say the communications technology, things that we can't control, things that we need some sort of moral, spiritual foundation and framework to be able to operate with. So in fact, you need religion more in modern times than you did in the past. And then another point he makes is that in the wealthier countries of the world, there's growing dissatisfaction. People have more than they've ever had in history, and they're not happier. They're, in fact, growing more and more dissatisfied. 2 years later, in 1963, he writes Pacem in Terris. Did I mention already in the last... that I asked my class about as big as... bigger than you, about 32 students, just 2 days ago, who's heard of... what does Pacem in Terris mean? And... nobody had an idea what Pacem in Terris means, and except for the president of the TI. It was in the Samuel Abraham, and he knew the answer. But actually, saying his name now is going to violate FERPA, wouldn't it, I think? But anyway, I don't think he will mind. Pacem in Terris, peace on earth. And it was where John the 23rd makes a number of also important points. And he says the big one is the individual is a person who has rights and duties. And the rights and the duties always go together. If you have a right, you have a duty. If you have a duty, you have a right. And so he's going to stress in a big way human rights. So this will be the first encyclical. Human rights is at least implicitly in Christianity from day one, even from the Jewish heritage. But by modern times, it's when they start coming with whole lists of human rights and what are your rights and what are your obligations. And so he's going to mention, he mentions more than 40 rights that you have as a human being. I will run through some of the list. And some of these will be very, you'll be surprised that they're rights. The rights that we all have. The right to the means necessary for proper development of life. You have a right to food, clothing, shelter, medical care, rest, and necessary social services. You have a right to be looked after in the event of ill health, disability stemming from your work, widowhood, old age, enforced unemployment, not like quitting your job for fun, but enforced unemployment, and whenever someone through no fault of their own is deprived of the means of livelihood. You have the right to be respected, even if you're not a respectable type person, presumably. Everybody has the right to be respected. You have the right to your good name, and this gets violated like all day long all over the country. You have right to freedom of speech and press and publication within the limits of the moral order and the common good. So these aren't absolute rights. You can't exercise them in ways that are going to be seriously harmful to morality or common. Say, for example, pornography. You don't have a right. You don't have a right to publish pornography, according to the Pope. The right to be accurately informed about public events. So when I go to a concert and I realize they put the wrong date on there and I show up and there's nobody there, that's a violation of my right. You have a right to know about public events. I think they really mean kind of when government, you know, governments will pull these tricks where they'll like have to, by law, have to have some public meeting, and they'll do it when. Not let people know exactly where it is. But that's your right to be informed. You have a right to a good general education and technical or professional training. I mean, if you're just treading water because your society offers you no opportunities at all, that's a violation of your rights. You have the right to educate your children. We heard about that in the last lecture. You have the right to be given the opportunity to work. You have the right to be allowed to exercise personal initiative in your work. If your boss isn't letting you take initiative, that's actually a violation of your right. You have a right to a just wage. And there's no, you know, they don't have some set formula that says what is a just wage, but generally, with the papal definition, and legally, Leo XIII already starts talking about just wage, and it's an issue right till today. The amount a worker receives must be sufficient in proportion to available funds to allow him and his family a standard of living consistent with human dignity. So you can't, you know, be scrounging around, living in a sewer, with your children starving. That's a violation of your rights. The most important point, I think, John the 23rd makes is the connection between rights and duties. That's a Catholic teaching, you know, right from the start. Because you have a right, you have a corresponding duty. And because you have a duty, if you have a duty, you have a corresponding right. So, for example, you have a duty to work. And that's an obligation. As a human being, you have a duty to work. But that also means you have a right to work that provides you with the means to support yourselves and your family. So if people are going to have a duty to work, they have to have a right to work as well, and vice versa. If you have a right to work, then you also have a duty. Property. You have a right to property, private property, but you have a responsibility to the common good. You know, you can't build a copper smelter in your backyard, for example, or turn your house into a drug den or all sorts of things you can do to abuse your property. Or I think one of the issues that came up, I think under John the 23rd, was some corporation or family in Italy owned enormous amounts of land, and there were shortages of grain, and the family wasn't planting anything. They were just sitting on their property, and they got at least condemned for that. You have a right to life, but that comes with a duty to take care of yourself healthily. When you wreck your body in all sorts of ways, live recklessly, live unhealthily, you still have your right to life, but you're shirking your duty to take care of your health. You have a right to seek the truth, but the duty to seek the truth. You have a right to free speech, but the duty to speak truthfully. When you lie and manipulate and swindle people with speech, you're violating your duty to speak the truth. Now, how this would have played out in legal system, or if there would even be laws on some of these issues, is a whole other question, and every different part of the world and political system and culture is going to work on that differently. But Pope's laying out the basic guidelines. And the big one was you have rights and you have duties, and they're interconnected. And it really strengthens the two. So if you have a duty to tell the truth, that strengthens the right of free speech. And John the 23rd says, and I think this goes back, you can take this back to at least Rerum Novarum too, is the way you have a harmonious society is when people recognize each other's rights and fulfill their own responsibilities. And if there's some problem in society, some social tension, social class, class conflict, and on, that's often because somebody's not recognizing somebody else's rights, or somebody's not fulfilling their responsibilities, or maybe it's a little bit of both. But that's the solution: is make sure you know your rights and make sure your rights are being respected, and do the obligations that you have that correspond with those rights. So that was what I got the most out of from Pacem in Terris. I'll say a little bit about Vatican II, since our two and these are all popes that are saints. These are the last three popes that were canonized. So we'll leave John the 23rd now. Vatican II, he calls it, and he's pope for the first year. Paul the VI is pope for the last 3 years. And the council has some important things I think I want to share with you. First of all, they said there are three errors in your approach to the world. There are three errors that you can make as a Catholic in your approach to the world. One is to shirk your responsibilities and be indifferent to the world around you. In fact, that could send you to hell. I'll quote the council. The Christian who neglects his temporal duties jeopardizes his eternal salvation. I think Pope Benedict XVI said things like that as well. So you can't just be indifferent. Like, for me, the temptation is really just like, to heck with everything. But that would be actually a sin, a mortal sin, even, at least implicitly here. Second error that people make is they engage in earthly affairs, but divorce it from their faith. So they may say, they'll believe one thing on Sunday, or at least go to a church that believes one thing on Sunday, and then the other 6 days of the week, they're politically active, trying to do something that violates the teachings of that church. So that's a problem as well. And then thirdly, to think your own personal political opinion is the gospel truth, that your word is the word of the church. The council said sometimes there's an obvious Christian position on specific issues, and solutions, but most often the faithful can disagree with each other with sincerity. The church speaks through your mouth, for example. That's another. So those are three areas. Indifference, separating your faith from your political engagement, and confusing your opinion with the opinion of God, gospel, or church. Another thing Paul VI says, and I always associate this with John Paul II, but it's now we can see it's earlier. He says, a man is more precious for what he is than for what he has. So being is more important than having. We'll come back to that. Paul wrote an encyclical called Populorum Progressio in 1967. He says, human solidarity doesn't just, Catholics have this view of solidarity. We have to at least care about everybody in the world. You can't write somebody off because you don't like their ethnicity or you don't like what part of the world they're from or their social class or on and on. You can't help everybody all the time. It's impossible, but you can't write people off. There has to be this sense that we're all in it together. We're a common humanity. We need to care about each other. And that's solidarity over space. And Paul VI says there's also solidarity over time, that we actually need to be in solidarity with future generations that aren't born yet. So when you're following certain policies today, you got to think, what is the impact this is going to have on future generations? This is kind of like, Chesterton says how tradition is the democracy of the dead. When you follow tradition, you're giving the dead a vote in your present time, which is a good thing. And this will be, with Paul VI's argument, it's kind of like now giving the future a vote. And subsequent popes, I think Benedict XVI and certainly Francis, have said the same thing, that we have a responsibility to the people not born yet. Paul also lays out kind of the three things about Catholic social teaching and about the Catholic Church that give it a special, special insight and special weight when it pronounces on these things. Number one, it has long experience. Been around for 2,000 years. It's faced just about every imaginable political system, political crisis, problem. So it's a lot of experience, institutional memory. Secondly, it has a global perspective. It's a religion that's all over the world. It engages with every culture, every religion, every situation. And then thirdly, it has a holistic view, both of the human person. You're not just a body. You're not just physiology. You have a soul. You have a mind. You have an intellectual life, a moral life, a cultural life, a spiritual life, alongside your biological life. And a holistic view of society. It's the same way society is not just about economics or politics. It's about your culture. It's about your religion. It's about the human society in its wholeness. The church is always against fragmentation, against splitting things up. It's against reductionism. It's 1971. And in years ending in a one, the Pope, about half the time or so, will issue an encyclical on Catholic social teaching. And that's because of Rerum Novarum was in 1891. So we get in 1931, we get a big one. We got the one here in 61. We got this in 71. We're going to get John Paul's in 91. So the years ending in one are these kind of social teaching years. So in octogesima adveniens, that's for 80 years after Rerum Novarum, Paul VI, among other things, will comment on the social sciences. That's a very interesting thing, his take on social sciences, because they're, the social sciences are problematic, but also in certain ways helpful. This would be sociology, anthropology. I'm going to read the five that he lists, and then if you put your hand up, if one of those is your major. Wait till I read all five, and then just dump it in. Sociology, anthropology, political science, history, psychology. What's yours?
History.
Okay. And where we're at? What school?
UCLA.
Okay, and then?
Psychology.
Okay, and then?
Houston.
Houston, right?
Yes.
No, okay. Paul talks about those. Now, on the one hand, they're reductionist because they give a partial explanation that oftentimes thinks it's the complete explanation. In a sense, kind of mutilate man. So, for example, if you're Freudian, you'll reduce human beings to psychosexual impulses. And if you're a Marxist, you'll reduce human beings to or even any kind of social sciences sometimes will reduce it to social economic forces. If you're a Darwinist, you'll reduce it to evolution, on and on and on. And so man gets mutilated. Each discipline thinks it has the fullest picture, but really they're all just partial pictures. And this is necessary on the one hand because you have different methodologies. A psychologist can't really explain certain historical things as well as a historian and vice versa and so on. And then also that there's ideological presuppositions. You get in many disciplines, there's a certain way of thinking. Oftentimes it's ideologically influenced. You've probably run into this yourselves in taking these sorts of classes. And so he warns against that. So he says, these human sciences are indispensable because that's how we do learn about humans and their history and the way they think and act and so on. But they're also inadequate. Always recognize that this is less than the whole picture. This is just a part. This is just a facet. And you've got to bring these all together, and there's got to be also the spiritual dimension. It's the most important dimension of all, of a human and of a society. And modern social sciences reject that altogether. So they're always going to be impartial, incomplete. And so you got to just keep that in mind and always try to integrate, bring these different... John Henry Newman talked about this in a 19th century version as well. Well, now we move to John Paul II. So in 1987, he'll issue a social encyclical called Solicitudo Rei Socialis. And he says, and he comes back to that having versus being. And he says that, we want to have, it's who you are is more important than what you have. So you want to focus on the having, I'm sorry, on the being, not the having. But he says, your being can be hindered if you have too much or if you have too little. Martin Luther said something like that. Better to be middle class because if when you're wealthy, there are certain temptations that you'll face up there that everybody else wouldn't. And if you're too poor, there are certain temptations that you'd face down there. Of course, being self-satisfied middle class person is probably a temptation too. But anyway, that idea that how much property you have, how wealthy you are, can lead you off track rather than keep you on track. He also, John Paul likes to mention too, that Catholic social teaching is all-encompassing in two ways. It addresses the whole human being, not just your body, not just economics. And it deals with every human being because it's this principle of solidarity. So John Paul II, I want to say a little bit about class struggle and social justice and harking back to Leo a bit here. So, and this is going to be in the encyclical, that's like the pinnacle of Catholic social teaching, and that would be Centesimus Annus. It gets this name because it's 100 years after Rerum Novarum. So John Paul is going to, and most of the rest of today, I'll just talk about that. And if you're going to read any one of these encyclicals, I'd say read that one first. It also has a section that talks all about Rerum Novarum, so it'd be like a nice intro to then go on to read Rerum Novarum, so you'd already kind of be familiar with it, and you'd already see how it impacted the church 100 years later. But so I'll talk about Centesimus Annus. So social justice for John Paul versus class struggle. So social justice is the good thing. You know, it's kind of besmirched in our day by the social justice warrior types, but it's for Catholics, it's supposed to be a good term. It's about, for John Paul, it's about human dignity, the common good, it's about reconciliation, reasonable compromise. It's, you're not going to get everything you want, nor is the other side, but you make some sort of a compromise where you each get something. It's about balancing interests. Class struggle is about mutual hatred. It's about partisanship. It's about bringing the concept of total war into domestic politics. You want to totally destroy. You want to own your opponent. You want to totally win. You want to knock them out. The goal is domination by your side, not getting compromises or balancing or harmony. And you use any means necessary. You'll lie, you'll cheat, you'll use terror, you'll use force. Indiscriminate means. And so he lays those out as the two options, and of course the church is with the social justice option. The other one sounds a lot like the U.S. today. John Paul's going to reiterate a lot of what Leo says in the next section of Rerum Novarum. So I want to say a little bit about Leo. So one of the problems with Rerum Novarum is it's written over 100 years ago. And it deals a lot with the two things the church is really condemning. Socialism, which really he means Marxism. Revolutionary Marxism. He doesn't mean like Swedish healthcare system or anything like that. But it's a revolutionary Marxism. And then when he uses the word liberalism,
Which means so many different things all over the world. It means different thing in the United States than it does in England, than it does on the continent of Europe. More, it means something different in 19th century in various places. So if you don't have a sense for what it would mean to Leo in the 1890s, you'll get misled by the writings. But it really means kind of uncontrolled capitalism, where there's no regulations, no safety regulations, market wage, or if somebody needs a job desperately and they're willing to work for slave wages or starvation wages, those are all things that are considered liberalism. It's giving too much freedom to the economy and the people that run it. I'll quote you from, that's you. Here's my phone. Okay, let's see. I have a quote here I just looked up. It's kind of a famous quote and by Leo about just the whole how the unregulated capitalism is kind of leading to Marxism because people are reacting against it. So he says, and some of this you'll recognize from already from the some of the concepts from the earlier lecture by Peter Brad. We clearly see that an opportune remedy must be found quickly for the misery and wretchedness that is pressing so unjustly on the majority of the working class. For the ancient working men's guilds were abolished in the last century, and no other protective organization took their place. So the guilds protected the working guy. And he'd have a little shop, they regulated certain things, and so they didn't get just plowed over by some big factory, and now... that protection is lost, and the only thing that replaces it is either Marxist labor unions that want to make revolution, or nothing, or no protection. And he says, public institutions and the laws set aside the ancient religion, that's us, hence by degrees it has come to pass that working men have been surrendered, isolated, and helpless to the hard-heartedness of employers and the greed of unchecked competition. So you got hard-hearted, greedy, bosses running these companies that now the workers have to work for. He doesn't have his little shop anymore where he's making shoes in the shop. Now he's in a giant shoe factory on the assembly line getting paid starvation wages. And then Leo says, the mischief has been increased by rapacious usury, which even though it's been more than once condemned by the church, it now under a different guide, but with similar injustice, is still practiced by covetous and grasping men. This is this last line. I like to give this to my students and not tell them who it's from. To this must be added that the hiring of labor and conduct of trade are concentrated in the hands of comparatively few, so that a small number of very rich men have been able to lay upon the teeming masses of the laboring poor a yoke little better than that of slavery itself. And that they all think it's Marx. Everything's Marx. or maybe Engels they'll throw in there. But you know, that's actually the Pope in 1891. And that's surprising. And then John Paul is going to kind of give the solution to that situation when we get we'll get to him pretty soon. So when did I start? Three. Oh yeah, perfect. I didn't want to be 25 minutes. So here. Okay. So one thing that the John Paul and Leo are going to say is the Pope, the state has a role, or your political leadership has a role to do the following: protect private property. So that's the state's obligation. The state's obligation to protect property, but not take your property away. Its obligation is to protect private property. It's to keep the currency stable. We forget about this, but you know, if you have an unstable currency, it's just like you're being robbed by the economy. And if it's the state's fault the currency is unstable, it's like they're just robbing you. Your money's becoming worthless. Provide efficient public services. And protect the workers in relationship with the owners because they are the weaker party. So the state has has the obligation to protect working conditions, just wage, and laws like that got passed just about everywhere over the last century. Not necessarily just, there are a lot of people around the world without a just wage, but the consumer protection, worker protection, we've got some of that now. And again, you need a wage adequate for the worker and his family. And it includes savings. You shouldn't just have to live paycheck to paycheck and save no money. If you live frugally, you should be able to accumulate wealth as well. And even have inheritance for your children. So all that's part of just wage. When we get to the age of John Paul, the big issue with the market economy, if you want to call it that, it isn't so much exploiting the worker, it's living off consumerism. It's convincing people to buy stuff they don't need, waste their money on things they don't need, get them addicted to all sorts of things that are just going to sidetrack their life. And then also to just kind of buy people's supposed happiness through material goods. So John Paul says, you know, this is the successes of market economy. There clearly are successes. He's living and watching it win the Cold War. But he says, you know, we're trying to defeat Marxism through prosperity. By we're going to be richer than them. We beat them through prosperity. Almost none of you are old enough for this, but anybody move from a communist country to a capitalist country across the border and saw the difference in whether you go from northwest Russia to Helsinki, or go from Bratislava to Vienna, or from Prague to Munich? It's a gigantic leap in standard of living, in the material, the quality, you name it, things look better. And so, they won. They outperformed the Marxist economically, but the problem is you're using the same standards that they use. It's all about material goods. It's all about economic situation. It's all about, it reduces the human person to economic and material needs. It leaves out the spiritual values as much as the Marxists do. It denies the autonomous value of, when you think it's all about the economy, every solution can be solved by the market. That's excluding now morality, law, culture, religion from the social system, just like the Marxists did when they expunged those things and said it's not part of the base social organization. John Paul also said we often think of poverty as purely economic, but there's cultural poverty, there's spiritual poverty, and we're called to love the poor and help the poor. That also means the spiritually poor, who are some of the richest people in the world. Sections 3 and 4 of Syntesimus Annus are the heart of the encyclical. If you're only going to read, if you easily want a kind of short reading, I'd say if you're not going to read the whole thing, read at least those sections. That's where John Paul has some of his famous quotes about just human person, human dignity. That's where he kind of lays out what a market economy should look like if it's functioning well and not unregulated and out of control. And he talks about just the nature of human person. So section 3 and 4, he said, it is not possible to understand man on the basis of economics alone, nor to define him simply on the basis of class membership. Man is understood in a more complete way when he is situated within the sphere of culture through his language, his history, and the position he takes toward the fundamental events of life, such as birth, love, work, and death. So this is holistic view of the human person, not reducing human person to material situation. At the heart of every culture, John Paul says, lies the attitude man takes to the greatest mystery, the mystery of God. And if your culture doesn't believe in God, that itself is a statement about the culture. Different cultures are basically different ways of facing the question of the meaning of personal existence. And when that question is eliminated, the culture and moral life of nations are corrupted. For this reason, the struggle to defend work was spontaneously linked to the struggle for culture and for national rights. And John Paul also believes in rights of nations, which I won't go into today, but that's another right you get. Marxism has promised to uproot the need for God from the human heart, but the results have shown that it is not possible to succeed in this without throwing the heart into turmoil. And these are some of the most, you know, he's not known as a poetic writer, but these are some of the most kind of poetic things that he's produced. I was really, hooked when I read Syntesimus Annus. I was so depressed by John Paul because of stuff like this. And then he turns on socialism and says, you know, the socialism, and again, by socialism, he means the Marxist revolutionary, the kind of system we had in Soviet Union and Poland and so on. And he said, its fundamental error is anthropological. It's a failed understanding of human person, of man. And its problems are with free will and with original sin. So it denies free will, for example. It's deterministic. Marx has scientifically discovered the laws of history and he can predict the future, and things have to turn out that way. There has to be a bourgeois revolution. There has to be a proletarian revolution. There's going to ultimately be the triumph of the socialist utopia. That's deterministic. That's like, what Calvinism does in theology, as Chesterton like to point out, Marx is doing in history. And so, John Paul's not naively saying we're not conditioned by things. And he says that, in fact, man is conditioned by numerous factors which influence his freedom, but they don't determine it. They can make exercising your freedom harder or easier, depending upon the situation, but they cannot destroy it. You always have that freedom to choose, even if within constraints. And then denial of original sin, we heard about this already in Father Brad's lectures, this utopianism. They're promising this utopia, this perfect future that there's no way they could deliver. And John Paul's going to say, and also when you think you have the perfect idea and somebody tries to stand in your way, you have no compunction about mowing them down. And so John Paul didn't say mowing them down, but he does say, this is utopian, and he says, when people think they possess the secret of a perfect social organization which makes evil impossible, they also think that they can use any means, including violence and deceit, in order to bring that organization into being. And that turns politics into a secular religion. It's operating under the illusion of creating paradise in the world. And he says, no political society can ever be confused with the kingdom of God. One of the points I like to make in classes, even if they have nothing to do with anything religious, is that if you're a non-believer and you have a Bible, I would say, if you just believe one verse from the Bible, or if humans had just believed one Bible verse, we would have saved ourselves a lot of misery. And the verse is the one about how there's an angel and a flaming sword guarding the gates of the Garden of Eden. That man is not getting back into the Garden of Eden. Man is not going to make paradise on earth unless some miraculous intervention by God. Your utopia will be in heaven, not anytime, anywhere on this earth. And the people that try to make that utopia, whether it's a thousand-year Reich or the communist future, bright future, are just going to bring a lot of misery on us in their effort. And so John Paul, very, very strong about that, that a utopian vision is really a dangerous one. And he says, as long as time lasts, the struggle between good and evil continues, even in the human heart itself. That sounds like the famous quote by Solzhenitsyn about the, it'd be great if all the evil people were somewhere, we could just remove them from the rest of society and destroy them, but the line between good and evil runs through the human heart. Everyone wants to destroy it, based on his own heart. John Paul lays out Catholic view of the human person. So if all these other things are wrong, what is right? And he says, man tends toward good, but he's also capable of evil. He could have said it the other way around. He could have said, man tends toward evil, but he's also capable of good. But you know, he's putting the stress on the good, which is, I think, a good thing for a Christian, particularly Catholic, to do. But recognize that man has this capacity for evil. He can transcend his immediate interest and still remain bound to it. So you're not totally determined by your situation, by your sex, your social class, your education level, what part of the world you live in, whether you're urban or rural. All those things are going to affect you. The age you live in. But they're not going to take away all your freedom. That you can transcend these circumstances as well. And this understanding of human person is important for understanding a society, for structuring a society. If you're writing your constitution and passing your laws and setting up your institutions, and you're getting this wrong, you're going to have problems. He says it's not wrong. Oh, this is a good one. Not that the other ones weren't good, but it is not wrong to want to live better. What is wrong is a style of life which is presumed to be better when it is directed toward having rather than being, and which wants to have more, not in order to be more, but in order to spend one's life, to spend life in enjoyment as an end to itself. If enjoying life is the end in itself to your life, that's wrong. That's a problem. And then he talks about those who consider their lives. He's talking about commitment. So he's talking, you know, if you want to have a family, which is a really good thing, and you know, get married, have a family, you need a person, you need people that are into commitment. And he says that if you live your life as a series of sensations to be experienced, rather than as a work to be accomplished, then you're not the kind of person that's going to make the kind of commitment that you would need to be a parent and raise a family. You can't have a stable relationship with another person and bring children into the world if they think life is really a series of sensations to experience rather than a work to be accomplished. So that came up maybe 2 months ago. Anybody heard of Brett Cooper? It's like a podcast person. So she had in one of her episodes, she featured, there was a Mormon dating show, and the guys and girls are up on the stage, you're up on the stage, and they have a curtain down the middle so you don't see the other side. But you can hear them. And then everybody reads off a note card like a statement about, like, you know, what kind of person am I? What am I looking for in life? What do I want in a partner? You know, what am I bringing to the table or whatever? And so this Brett was kind of really disturbed by this. There was this young woman gets up and she says that she loves adventure and she's scuba diving and skydiving. She even has a license for that stuff. And she wants a travel buddy to go off all over the world for these adventures. And not a single guy wanted to talk to her. They're just like, Brett was kind of disturbed, but I was a little disturbed too. I thought she seemed like a fun girl. I don't want to scuba dive or skydive, but I wouldn't mind having some fun in global travel. But anyway, so Brett was distressed. And then I read the comments. And mostly by guys, and there were dozens and dozens of them. And it was like they were totally on the side of the guys. They were totally, and they were articulating very intelligently why they wouldn't want a woman like that. He said, spending a ton of money on frivolous interests. She's going to get bored with you, just like she gets bored with everything else. That's why she needs more and more compensation. That sort of thing. And so not a good person that's going to be stable and on and on and on. And so they really articulate. You know, Brett, I agree with everything you say all the time, but I'm not going to agree on this one. And it was literally, they were articulating exactly the poach I'm all saying. Exactly, almost verbatim. I don't think they're reading since it was Anos in Mormon church, but who knows. But anyway, these guys had this sense that, you know, there was just something not quite right about that. And it's a good, because, you know, it gets people thinking. Even if you're, I've triggered people with my reading of that. Somebody who chased sensations all her life and is now kind of about middle-aged and wishes she was married and isn't, got really triggered. And then a friend of mine who did the same thing, just kind of frittered his life, and he feels really guilty now and wants to change. So, it affects people, and I think it shows that, you know, we think of Catholics always changing about these about policy questions, theological questions, and these big issues with societies and economies and on, but there's parts of it that are just really practical information for your own life, or at least things that will get you thinking about your own life and your choices. John Paul is going to oppose the idolatry of the market. The market wins. When he's poked, the market wins. And he's going to be friendlier towards the market than probably previous popes. But he says, you know, the market economy has to be understood in the proper way. So the bad way is if you absolutize the market, if you make the production and consumption of goods the center of social life, if you make that society's only value, if it's not subject to any other values, if there's no other values kind of reining it in or controlling it or channeling it, that's not the fault of the economic system. That's the fault of the culture and society that thinks that way. So don't blame the economic system, but blame the culture that it's situated in, because that culture is ignoring the ethical and religious dimension and limiting things to just production of goods and services alone. John Paul says, if by capitalism you mean an economic system, here's the good capitalism. It recognizes the fundamental and positive role of business, of the market, of private property, and the resulting responsibility for the means of production. So you have property, you have responsibility to use that property toward the common good. It recognizes free human creativity in the economic sector. Business has a lot of creativity in it. I don't know if any of your business majors, but you got to plan things, decide on business plans. I'll say that. I'll tell you what John Paul says about that in a minute. He says that that's the kind of economy it should be. It should be circumscribed within a strong juridical framework. There should be laws in place, a justice system in place, so the workers aren't abused. That the market should be at the service of human freedom. You know, if the market, what the market is for you, not you for the market, would be the way he would put it. So you have this kind of a framework, a moral, ethical, spiritual framework, and the market operates within that, not absolutizing, not running everything, not being everybody's answer to every question. So he said there's two approaches to this market economy, one good, one bad. He prefers, instead of saying capitalism, to say market economy, free economy, business economy. But it's got to be, it's better than socialism, at least better than the Marxist type, but it also needs to be, it would have some kind of constraints to channel it in the proper direction, lest it turn into this oppressive system like Leo the 13th had to deal with. John Paul's big on subsidiarity. That's where you make decisions best addressed to the closest to the people in need and best addressed privately rather than publicly. Don't run to the government for all the problems. There should be local organizations running, you know, schools and food banks and so on, it's health clinics and so on. And only the state has an obligation to step in when those needs aren't being met privately. And you should always deal with something locally rather than through the central government, because the local people know the situation around them in the way that distant bureaucrats don't. He says so the state's job is to support these other groups, facilitate their work, but not impede their work. When you violate subsidiarity, you lose human energies, you increase bureaucracy, you have an enormous increase in spending by the government. And when government does intervene, because it has to do this sometimes, it's its obligation, it should be brief, it should be for urgent reasons only, and it should concern the common good, not just some special interest group trying to get some scamming off the government. The positives, I'll kind of conclude with this. The positive and negative things he says about business and entrepreneurship. So it has many virtues. You know how you're organized if you're in business. You're disciplined. You're creative. You got to be reliable. You got to be trustworthy. Your customers need to rely on you. Your suppliers need to rely on you, and vice versa. It's about fidelity. It's about hard work. It's about exercising good judgment. You exercise bad judgment, you're gonna lose in the economic race. And it's about courage in making difficult and painful decisions, as anybody has to make when they run a business. The problem with free market, it excludes me. This is an important point. This will be one of my last points. One of the points Jean-Paul makes is with free market is it's not the market economy that's the problem, it's the people being excluded from it. And he gives two examples. One, there are parts of the world that are so poor that they're having trouble trading with the rest of the world. And when the church gets more explicit about this, usually it's Africa is the major victim. And the problem is Africa produces produce more cheaply than a lot of places. But Europe won't buy the produce from Africa because they have their own, like, you know, former colonies and whatnot, and their own farmers. And so the Africans have trouble cracking in. They're not cracking into the free market because the market's being kind of closed to them. So the market really isn't operating when you exclude certain countries or regions of the world. And then also people in your own society who have no skills, have nothing to sell, no talents, and they're totally marginalized. They're just a perpetual underclass. And that if you have those people in your society, then you owe them a training, you owe them education, you owe them that there needs to be, they need to be able to take some place in the economic system and not just be perpetually marginalized. So the other problem would be it can't meet everybody's needs. There are just some things, usually healthcare and education get on the list, that something the market alone can't solve. And then also, it creates artificial needs. It wants to get you to buy things that you don't really need, but you think you do need. So you have to, you get to spend money and keep the businesses going. And it's really, a real problem is, and this goes back to Pius XI already wrote about this, it exploits the weak. It takes advantage, it literally tries to get people to addicted to things. Whether it's alcohol, whether it's drugs, whether it's pornography, whether it's your telephone. The purpose is to addict you and keep getting your stream of money out of you, and that creates all sorts of problems. We have my university. They want to be cost efficient and cost effective and so on. So they'll close down. So for example, we had a faculty club where faculty and staff could go have lunch, and it wasn't profitable. So they just shut it down. It's just like gone. You took job candidates for dinner. You took visiting speakers. It's where faculty could interconnect with each other. The Newman Center used to run every quarter like a luncheon for faculty and graduate students and staff that are Catholic. And all of those opportunities are just gone. Or the art students had their own cafe called, I think, Parnassus. And then the university cut some contract with Starbucks, and they just started closing these places down. So the art students, they weren't profitable enough, so they don't. And their profits all went into art scholarships anyway. And they said, oh, no, just get rid of that, close that down, because we're about efficiency and profitability. And when you start to bring, when it's all about profitability, all sorts of things that are serving other types of human needs start to disappear because they're not part of the profitability. So we see this even on the lower levels around society, let alone on the largest scale. So that's just kind of a smattering of Catholic social teaching by the three popes that have been canonized. If you're interested in more, they all have encyclicals on these kinds of issues. As I said, Centesimus Annus would be the best one. It's also a good intro to Rerum Novarum, which would be the next best one probably, and the ones from the 1930s, as Father Breth's already quoting from some of them. Those are well worth reading as well, although it's about a world kind of different than, I know everybody's trying to pretend we're reliving the 30s today, but it really was a different world from today, but still worth studying and learning things about.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.